The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hiller. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small cap. So big welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, and hello, everyone. Sorry if my connection might be a bit wobbly. I'm just loading up a massive spreadsheet, so fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, we certainly don't want it to interfere with your internet access and your broadband, but it's been a relatively quiet or peaceful period over the last 7 days as people have gone off on holiday, thank God, after all the really sort of deluge of corporate results in July. So we just sort of take a step back. A lot's been happening on the markets over the last 2 or 3 months. Just big picture. Anything of sort of like standout significance that we should consider going forward?
Not really. I mean, I just think at the moment, certainly in small caps, we're very much now in the summer doldrums, I think, aren't we? Volumes are dropping. Lots of shares have drifted down substantially, actually, from the peak in June and July. A lot of people are just, you know, on my discussion board are saying, what on earth's going on with so-and-so? You know, and it's dozens and dozens of shares are giving back a lot of the gains they previously made. So I think we're getting into buying territory again. Definitely a trader's market, isn't it? You know, something goes up 50%, you bank your profits and then just wait for it to come back down again. That seems to be what's working at the moment. But macro, no, I don't think it's more of the same, isn't it? The tariff stuff, the market seems to be taking in it in its stride now, globally, I mean.
I would add on that tariff thing, what it seems to have done, plus the introduction of extra NI in April. There were sort of like, you know, coincident dates, etc. In the start of Q2. What it's meant, you've had a deluge now of companies. In fact, nearly all companies are cost cutting and made it into a really quite a tough job market. And that's actually helped stop some of the sort of input cost inflation being pushed into selling price, because we haven't yet seen that really come through in the inflation figures. It's about a bit of uptick. And then the other thing which I felt was quite interesting, because we've had the dollar weakening on the back of the tariffs, that's actually helped and absorbed some of the inflation, because oil prices in dollar terms has gone down in sterling terms, for instance. And lots of sort of commodities have as well. So I think on the back of all that, then you've had the US market rebounding, and now you've got some really stretched valuations. I mean, I looked at some of the, you know, the bubbles out in the States, and you've got one company, Palantir, which probably people know about, which, do you know what multiple of sales that is?
I haven't looked at it, so I wouldn't know.
It's got three figures starting with it. 100 times. It's on 100 times sales. And the other thing I would just say is a standout to me, thinking about sort of like going forward for the second half after, you know, into the autumn, is the amount of deferred decision makings. Because we see that all the time in terms of not just factories and discretionary spend, but you had Savills reporting today, and they've seen a marked reduction in UK investment into property. Not so much office, actually, but the ones which have been the winners before. You've had a big deceleration in Q2 as people who have actually, you know, wanted to buy have just held off on those particular purchases, and also in the defence. So big themes, I would say, of the last 3 months, we just need to make sure we consider going forward. It isn't an easy market. Corporates are still cost-cutting. Job market is tough, no doubt about it. Inflation hasn't gone absolutely, you know, rampant as you would might imagine, because the dollar's sort of absorbed it. But if you're in a company with a lot of discretionary spend and big capital items, that's still that hasn't fixed itself yet, even though the markets are have come back strong.
Yeah, I think those are all really good points, actually, Paul. I mean, the profit warnings, yes, we've had quite a few profit warnings, but certainly in the last week, it's just been really small companies. There've been no kind of earth-shattering oh my God, from big company profit warnings, have there really? So I have to say, given everything that's been thrown at corporates UK and corporates globally over the last 5-6 years, been nonstop chaos, I'm actually quite surprised that the economy isn't worse than it is. The GDP figures today were reasonable, weren't they? And as you say, the inflation should, there are good reasons to think it should wash through the system. Interest rates are down a bit. I'm actually just mildly, gently optimistic now for the next 6 months, but for the reasons you say, actually. I don't see a catalyst for things getting worse, put it like that. Although one thing I did pick up, which I think was from Ultimate Products, which you know very well.
Yeah.
He said they'd taken a £3 million hit on additional freight costs. Now, that surprised me. That was on about 150 million a year revenue. So quite significant, 2% of revenues. So maybe that could offset some of the benefits of the dollar weakness making imports cheaper. I don't know, possibly.
Where do they get the products from? Is it China? Is it they imported from China?
I'm pretty sure it's China,
That's so crazy, isn't it?
It did surprise me. Yeah, freight costs. But there we are.
I'll tell you what that is. I mean, I bet you that is actually China diverting its exports from the US to Europe, isn't it? It's dumping product, and therefore your container ships. Sounds though. I mean, I'd like to cross check that.
It surprised me because we've not seen other companies say that particularly, have we?
No, not at all. No, but coming back to sort of optimism. I mean, I don't know if you remember. There's a guy called Rubini, basically Doctor Doom.
Oh yes, Doctor Doom, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, he's now Doctor Boom. He actually said, for the first time in 30 years, I've ever known the guy. Because he was very famous, wasn't he? Well, he's a big economist out in the States. I've always been Permabear. And for the first time for sort of 2-3 decades, he's now saying because of the AI revolution, productivity growth in the US is going to overcome all the tariffs. And he's actually saying they're going to have sort of like they're going to have like 3-4% GDP growth by 2030 because of the productivity lift in the US. So, I mean, that's either something to be positive on or something to be negative, because when you get the last bear in the market...
I was just about to say that. That's very interesting. And I also flagged something in one of my reports this week, something at a Bank of America fund manager survey says that they are now completely over tariffs. You know, this was statistical, it was shown on a graph. They thought there was 45% of them thought that there was going to be a hard landing in April. It's now down to 5%. So basically, they're over the whole tariffs thing already in America, fund managers are. And they also think that stock valuations are too high, but they're anticipating further QE. Now that thought was really interesting. So this seems to be partly what's driving, and of course Trump. You know,
and why QE? Is that to bring the long-term yields down?
Yeah, because I think Western governments are going to have to do that. It's unsustainable, particularly for the US paying 4 or 5% on your 10-year gilts. So I'm not saying they should do that. I don't have an opinion on it, but I think I've been saying for several years. I think QE is such a convenient device for governments that they'll find a way of influencing central banks to go back to that regime. Now, if I'm right in that, and this is, so it was music to my ears when I heard that US fund managers think the same, that's super bullish for bonds and, well, for all asset prices. Yeah. If we're going back to 1-2% interest rates, that's seriously bullish.
Yeah, it's not good for the dollar. it's gonna weaken. If nobody else does QE, that is. I mean, it's all relative, isn't it?
I think they'll be the UK will be itching to do it if they can, because when they all do it together, there's nothing to devalue your currency against, is there? I mean, that's what we saw during the whole the 14 year zero interest. It's a fascinating experiment, and if they hadn't done quantitative tightening, actually governments wouldn't have a funding issue. It's all above my pay grade, but I just think in terms of where we position ourselves. And I have to say, UK small caps, again, are just the standout bargain area. I've looked at a lot of UK large caps in the last couple of months. A lot of them, I think, are quite pricey. And they've got terrible, highly geared balance sheets, a lot of them as well. So you're getting better balance sheets and much lower earnings multiples and probably better growth potential as well. So I think UK small caps is looking relatively a cracking sector right now.
Great, great. Well, okay, well, let's move on to some stocks. We've got Peter T. He's asking about our conversation with Treat, which is the natural flavours of how do we get on. And now we spoke to their CEO yesterday, Dave Shannon. Do you want to give us your take on it? I own the shares, so it'd be good for you.
Okay, do you want to go first, Paul? Because you know it better than me, and I can fill in anything you miss, maybe.
Okay, I mean, basically, the company supplies natural citrus oils and flavors into the drinks market, largely into people like traditionally into Pepsi and Coke, but also into sort of like ready to drink alcoholic drinks, but coffees and teas and stuff like that. And they've got their heartland is in the UK, but they've got a facility out in Florida in the States, and they've got one out in China. Anyway, we spoke to Dave Shannon after initial profit warning in the first half at sort of like, I don't know, I think it was April or something like that, which wasn't great. And then they resized the ship to have, you know, basically to deliver on the second half. Anyway, they were so far off, they had to come out with another profit warning. So he took us through the reasons for it. And it was really a catalogue of things going wrong. I mean, basically, first of all, they had some large contracts that pushed to the right, and they will be delivered next year in the 2026. Plus, they were anticipated some spot market, but they got caught on the wrong side of their input cost for the orange oil on the hedging agreements, which meant that they effectively lost money on the spot market when other people could undercut them. So that didn't exactly help them either. And frankly, they haven't got enough customers either. They have to diversify their customers a bit more, which he's now changing that culturally. So there was a question over the, you know, how good that forecasting process was, plus how close the sales guys were to their particular clients on that particular ordering. So they got that far wrong. However, having put all that together, we're not talking of a sinking ship. They've got a good balance sheet, decent. They're only very small in debt. All their facilities are well done, and he's hoping to see some recovery in the next financial year as they win more customers. But it is that there is a cultural change here. But he seemed to me, he came across well, he came across frank, and he came, importantly for me, quite hungry in terms of getting this business right. So, you know, I backed him. I think he's still the man for the job. But having said that, the shares are not exactly, you know, doing well, and I'm down on my particular, you know, investment so far. But if they can turn it around, improve the margins, he's hoping to double the margins from about 8% to 15%, then the shares will go back again. But there's a lot of self-help he needs to do. What was your take, Paul?
I think you've covered most of it there. I mean, what surprised me, very, very straightforward, open CEO. And I've actually encouraged him to get some investor webinars out there, because I think, given, as you say, that they've had two pretty disastrous profit warnings, he needs to get the message out to private investors. And he took that on board. So I'm hopeful something will happen on that front. As you say, one phrase he said something along, this is a bump in the road year. So he said, you know, because what I always try to get to the bottom of when companies had two profit warnings, you know, is there something permanently broken here, or structural decline? And I think there might be an element of that in a small way, in that it really became clear how competitive this sector is. I suspect, and this is just my hunch, I think they grew under old management, maybe the staff, the culture of the firm, maybe grew a bit too complacent. They had lucrative recurring business. And what he's saying now is that the soft drink side of things in particular is changing. The market's changed in that people don't have this strong brand loyalty. Younger people are now, you know, you or I are just, you know, we buy Diet Coke automatically when we go into a shop when we're thirsty, don't we? And he's saying the young people are not like that now. They're pretty, you know, they'll quite happily buy own brand supermarket drinks, and all this proliferation of energy drinks and all these new brands coming in. So basically, my take on it is I think Treat are having to work harder to win new business. And he said the sales team need to be more hungry. What was it? I can't remember. Hunters rather than farmers. You know, yes. I think they were more account managers and just waiting for the phone to ring with repeat orders, and they've now suddenly realized, 10 or 15% of the business actually leaks away each year. We've got to replace it actively. So a lot of it did sound like the basics of running a business, I've got to say. I know it's not easy running businesses. It's competitive. I think they've been caught napping to a certain extent. But everything he was saying, you know, in the what we're doing to fix it section of our talk, I think everything sounded just like sensible common sense to me. So yeah. I reckon this should be a good turnaround, but I think you could be looking at a couple of years to get everything straightened out. But in the meantime, someone might bid for it. So I do think, because as you say, the balance sheet's very strong and it's got all these spangly new factories, somebody might nip in and buy it. So I think it could be one to just tuck away. I'm tempted to buy half position size and just tuck it away in case there's a bid. That's everything I've got on it, really.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I had exactly the same view. This is a 2-year turnaround. That turnaround has taken longer than they originally anticipated. It's a cultural change. There's some low-hanging fruit they can do. Their forecasting and their sales count management, definitely. And they've got a lot of underutilized capacity in those factories.
Good point.
So if they start getting shifting volume, you'll see operational gearing, you'll see your gross margins going up, and you'll see your profitability improving significantly. And that's what they need to do. And frankly, if they screw up again, I'm sure somebody will buy them.
Yeah, I think you're right. Risk reward at this point, I think, is not bad. And it could be one of these shares where, say, on a third profit warning, which you can't rule out. Yeah. We don't know. We didn't get any inkling either way, I don't think, from him. They can't tell us anything price sensitive. So and they didn't. But I think if there is a third profit warning, it wouldn't surprise me if it was one of these things a bit like Somero Enterprises, where it opens 20-25% down and closes almost flat.
Yes.
You know, I think so because you've got that bulletproof balance sheet, you don't have any dilution risk. The stale bulls are probably largely gone, and the people in it are looking at it for a future turnaround anyway. So I think risk reward on Treatt paradoxically could actually be quite reasonable now. I've decided not to buy any myself, mainly because I haven't got any money, and I think there are probably better opportunities in the short term. But I might at some point just, as I say, nip, just buy a small position. Yeah. And let it run for a year and see what happens.
Yeah, I'll just tell on people on highlight on valuation grounds. THG, the Hut Group, sold a food ingredients business to private equity about last week, I think, on 14 times EBITDA, because food ingredients businesses go for pretty good prices. Treatt currently trades at about 8 times EBITDA on trough EBITDA.
Yeah.
So it just shows you what this can work. If this works and gets around, there's significant upside in terms of multiple expansion and EBITDA and earnings expansion. So there's plenty
Those
of upside.
Really good points. Yeah, that's a great point. And for all the doom and gloom, it's still forecast to make about 9 million quid profit this year. And because they've got large factories, a very substantial depreciation charge. So the cash flow, it's generating plenty of cash. It's still profitable. So as I say, I don't hold any myself, but I can see probably more upside than downside on this.
Yeah, and if there's another problem, I'm sure Lord John Lee will be banging on the table and absolutely holding their feet to the fire if it doesn't.
He's been a very, very long-term bull on this, hasn't it?
Yeah, he has,
Okay,
good. Let's move to another stock that seemed to have plenty of upside. The shares have come off. Let's go to Warpaint. We've got Gary Jordan. He can't believe that the shares have almost halved from their peak, which is only about 9 months ago. What's going on here, he says?
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, I did mention this in my podcast, I think maybe yesterday or the day before, doing a trawl of the market and looking at big recent fallers. I mean, this peaked at nearly £5 in late May, and we're now down to £3.10.
Yeah.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Paul, but I don't think there's been any recent trading updates for it.
No, I haven't seen it either. No. This just for everybody. This does sort of like it's a challenger cosmetics brand that recently bought, I think it was a tanning business, a small one, Brand Architects, and has been integrating it. And it's obviously been hit a bit by tariffs as its imports, it gets its products from China and then imports a bit to the States. But the States is still less than 10% of sales. Most of it goes to the UK and Europe, I think.
I was just going to make that point as well, actually. That's the right. Maybe I think the trouble is at the moment in the summer, doldrums is selling, sort of creates more selling. And then everyone starts wondering, oh, the sellers must know something's up. And so you get a buyer's strike combined with low-level selling. It could easily be fund managers needing to liquidate. I suspect strongly there's still small-cap fund liquidations going on. You can just see that in some of the irrational price moves in lots of things at the moment. It's looking very, very tempting at £3.10, I agree. Warpaint. I've got a forward PE of 11.6, forecast yield of 4%. It's got a strong balance sheet with net cash. As you say, US tariffs will only affect a relatively small part of its market. It's looking tempting, isn't it? But when you jump in into a collapsing share price like that, you've got to be brave, haven't you? Because it can be that somebody's selling. And we should also mention for balance that management did sell a substantial amount of shares themselves not long ago, which I don't like. I don't like it when founders take a substantial amount of money off the table, which because quite often, you know, I mean, they still have, what is it? Just widen that page a bit.
They have they still have a shed load. I mean, I know we talked about
shed load.
Yeah, I know we chatted about this before, but I have less of a problem because these guys, they own about 50 million quid's worth of shares and you're selling about 2 or 3 million and it's sort of
like... Oh, sorry, you're right. Yeah, it wasn't a huge amount they sold. No, I was getting muddled up with, what's the telecom software thing where the founder sold a third of it?
Yes.
You know the one? That's tanked as well. But this begins with C. This one, you're right. They only sold 1% each or something. They've still got 19% each. So, scrub that. That's not a concern. So, I think Warpaint, don't hold any myself. I'd be very tempted to be buying a few at this level. Yeah, definitely.
Good. Another one which has dropped off a bit. It's a question from Steve Russell. He's asking about electrosurgical specialist in the medical area, Creo Medical, and it's got sort of three parts to its valuation. It owns about 50% of this European electrosurgical business, which it sold the other 50% to China, to a Chinese manufacturer, for about 35 million quid or something. It's got about 10 million of cash, so that's 45, and then its market cap is only 53, and its last part of the business is this high potential sort of like electrosurgical speedboat type of laryngoscopic device that goes onto things like Da Vinci machines. Anyway, what's your take on really the Creo Medical? Because it's not profit, Matt. It isn't profitable, but it is high potential.
Yeah, that's a good way of summing it up, actually. I mean, we cover this stock a lot. We've covered it seven times so far in my my daily reports this year. Every time, though, we've said we don't know how to value it. We can't give it one of a, because it's not a value share. It's a big loss maker, you know, substantial losses every year, heavy cash burner. The latest news on it, I've got a trading update dated 21st of July. It's in line with expectations, but you see substantial loss. But reduced to 6.9 million operating loss in H1, which is almost half the prior. So the losses do seem to be reducing, and it's the latest cash figure at the end of June was 20.5 million pounds, plus this 49% stake in CME. This is the thing it found down the back of the sofa that raised about 30-odd million.
That must be a big sofa, 30-odd million.
Yeah, I know. I couldn't believe it when that deal was announced because I hadn't even, it was loss-making. Yeah. I just valued it at nil, but what do I know? Anyway, they've still got a 49% stake in it, which they're valuing at €36 million. So maybe they could sell that. So it looks like it could be financed for the foreseeable future. But they're really starting from almost nothing. You know, the revenues were only just over 2 million in H1. So they've got a real mountain to climb to commercialize the speedboat products. So the only conclusion I can come to is I haven't got the foggiest idea how to value it at this stage, yeah. But it does look an interesting product. You're right, Paul.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm likewise. It's impossible to value at the moment, other than I think you've got a firm 45 million, or certainly a firm 30 million, which is the other 50% of that existing back of the sofa type business. They will need the cash to develop the speedboat proposition, and that leaves you with roughly 25 million valuation on that other, you know, bit of IP. And then it really is, it's what somebody else could do with that technology if you put it to like Da Vinci Surgical Intuitive. And then, but you're right, it's a finger in the air, isn't it, really?
It is a finger in the air. And also with these things that have got big cash piles relative to the market cap, I think it's a mistake to take the cash pile off and say, let's value it on the EV, when the cash pile is basically allocated to be burnt.
Yeah.
Do you see, you know, so I if it's on a heavy cash burn trajectory, I just write off the remaining cash and say, right, we know what's going to happen to that cash. It's going to disappear. So so EV can be a very dangerous concept with highly cash burning companies, but I wish them well. It does sound a very promising product for sure.
Yeah. Good. I love this format because the audience participation, we've got Vincent, he's basically saying, is that company we were thinking of Cerulean by any chance? And I thought, is it?
Yes,
exactly. I know. Thanks, Vincent.
He gets 10 points bonus.
I know. Yeah. Another one. Another great observation. Brian, he basically says that in the FT today, they had an article which was talking about business rates going up in the budget or something for large supermarkets.
Yes, I've seen that.
Yeah, is that going to impact? The question is that going to impact people like the supermarket income REIT? You know, because who owns some of these supermarkets? It's quite interesting in terms of if it's going to knock 10 bells out of people who own supermarkets, all these big properties, and they go bust. Who will renew the lease when it comes up? I guess would be the question.
I think that's a really good point. No immediate impact for sure, because unless the tenant goes bust, which is extremely unlikely for any of the significant UK supermarkets. But yeah, I think he's right. Longer term, I mean, I remember, I think I might have mentioned this before, I wrote to the government when I was a retailing FD about how much pain business rates were doing us. And I got a very thoughtful reply.
Are you taking the mic there, Paul?
No, this is in the 1990s, so okay. A long time ago. And they basically said, look, business rates and rents need to be seen together. So if business rates go up over time, as our questioner here was suggesting, it puts the squeeze on rents downwards because the tenants won't agree to a 20% rental uplift if they've just been clobbered by business rates. So I think he could have a point, but with a deferred longer term effect. Yeah.
No, it'll be interesting to watch that. Thanks for that, Brian. Okay.
And of course, it fuels inflation, doesn't it? All these tax rises indirectly fuel inflation, which then means the government has to stump up another 10 or 20 billion in public sector wages. So you could argue that the money, any additional tax money they raise actually costs them in the long run because they're pushing up inflation. So the supermarkets have to raise prices. We've seen that happen in the last year, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't see them putting up VAT, that's for sure, in the autumn budget. If they're gonna move some big levers to get that 40 billion hole in the government's budget, it's probably going to be income tax. It's the only one left, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah,
but they gave a manifested commitment not to touch any of those, didn't they?
I didn't believe that.
What about gambling taxes, Paul? That's what I'm worried about. I think that's such a quick win for the government. I'm avoiding all gambling shares right now.
Well, we had one today, didn't we? Which was, what was it called?
Was it Rank? Evoke or
was it Rank? Yeah. We had Rank, didn't we? They came out, which is the casino operator. And the shares
very good numbers, really good.
The shares have done brilliantly. They own Grosvenor, don't they? They've done brilliantly over the last two or three years as they've put in more fruit machines, essentially, or those slot machines into their casinos. They've been allowed to, but yeah, I'm with you. I wouldn't be going into them, you know, wading in because I've got a sneak suspicion. You're right; they're bound to, aren't they?
It's a quick win, and already it's been sounded out in the press, which tends to be what governments do just to in advance to see what the feedback is, and they're linking it, aren't they? A 3 billion hit on gambling companies in the UK can be justified for social reasons, and they're linking it to increases in child benefits. So I think I would work on the basis that's probably going to happen. But yeah, lovely figures from Rank. I dropped it this morning from Amber Green to Amber, which is on my system is 4-star to 3-star, because it's had such a great run. And I think it's kind of more or less up with events now at 17 times. And all these gambling companies have such bloody awful balance sheets. I mean, the big ones are the worst. They're terrible, up to their eyeballs in debt. Although Rank is not too bad. It's negative net tangible asset value. But the big ones, I mean, the worst one is the biggest, Flutter.
Yeah.
Hideous balance sheets. Absolutely hideous. Yeah.
Well, never mind. Okay, good.
Maybe gambling companies are run by gamblers. Who max out the overdraft and, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, another one in the in social housing maintenance is Mears, which has done really well, the shares have. About 10% or 20% of the business, I think, is locked into the asylum seekers and doing the looking after those sort of like, you know, the properties they stay in and maintain them, etc., which the government is trying to obviously extricate itself from it. What's your sort of your latest on Mears? I mean, the shares have done remarkably well, and they still only trade on less than 9x PE is what I've got.
I know. It's very good. I looked at this on the 7th of August, which was last Friday, wasn't it? I really like it. I mean, we were amber green on it, which is 4 out of 5 stars. I upped it to 5-star, actually, a week ago. This was on H1 results. They said it was an excellent H1, but that was their words. But PBT was actually only up 5%. I don't know if that qualifies as excellent. But notably, diluted EPS was up 20% because they've done enormous buybacks, Mears have. And I love it when companies on a really low single-digit PE do big buybacks, because that's the time to do it when the shares are cheap. Now, they have been forecasting for a year or two that the asylum seeker contracts would wind down. But I actually think we're looking at the opposite, because the government is now under so much pressure to close these asylum hotels, and we won't get into the politics of it. Everyone's got their own view on that. I'm not going to offer a view. But what apparently is happening now is that by the back door, the government's procuring normal housing, you know, not hotels. Well, that says to me, demand that Mears can supply could well actually end up going up. And it's got I really like it, discloses its average daily net cash, which is a brilliant disclosure that all companies should do that. So it's good value. It's got upbeat prospects. The outlook statement said modestly ahead of market expectations and increasing confidence for June 2026 as well. So yeah, I think Mears looks really attractive. I don't hold any personally, but I think it looks very good.
Yeah, I'm with you. If you want a steady Eddie type of stock, it isn't going to knock the ball out of the park in the next 2 years as they get that headwind of the asylums. But that may not turn out as badly as people are expecting.
Well, I think it's a tailwind.
Yeah, I don't think the market does. I've read a broker note and they reckon 250 million of turnovers coming out. You know, that's a paid for broker from the company. They reckon 100 million of turnovers going out this year in 25, 150 million of turnovers dropping out 26, and then the last 50s in 27. But I'm with you. I mean, let's be clear about it. It's taken a hell of a lot longer to make any impact at all so far on the business, and it could easily draw out, because what the government wants and try and do in terms of asylum seekers, it just hasn't happened. So
the opposite happens, doesn't it? So but it's good that the company's forecasting on a prudent basis, which could I strongly suspect that would mean ahead of expectations updates probably.
Yeah.
As government policy inevitably collapses,
yeah,
as we're used to in many. No, I mustn't go.
Good. We've got Rob. He's asking about Pennant International turnaround opportunity there. They basically do simulators, I think, for training air pilots and sort of cadets and stuff in the defense sector. They sort of like do simulators to help them actually train certain plane on certain planes. What's your thoughts? They had a contract that got pushed to the right with the UK MOD just recently.
Yeah, they did. This was 8th of August, Pennant, PEN. Yeah, a big UK contract delayed. And it was previously an H2 waiting outlook, and it's now turned into a profit warning, as H2 weightings quite often do. We were very disappointed with this because the company and the promoters had been out, you know, telling us all that this is a great turnaround story and everything. And then it comes out with a bombshell profit warning. You just can't do that. As my old boss in my retailing days said to me when I suggested we did some PR, he said, no, he said, wait till we got the product right. When you've got something to shout about, then you shout about it. So I think they messed this up. And it does emphasize that it's still very dependent on single large lumpy contracts. It's got, you know, a very patchy history. I think it's a good company, Pennantis, and I'd like to believe the turnaround story, but obviously this has dented my my confidence in it. We also feel it did a sale and lease back of its freeholds, which always looks a bit desperate. And the bank have, one of my readers pointed out that the bank have dropped the overdraft facility from $3.5 million to $2 million because they've got less physical security now. And in the latest update, it said the net debt is $2 million. Well, that implies they're maxed out on the overdraft, unless they've included the lease numbers in that net debt figure. They should have made it clear. So I think the jury's out on this one at the moment. I wish them well, but I'm not prepared to just take a leap of faith on it. So I'm neutral on Pennant for the time being, and I will happily pay a little bit more if in the future they can demonstrate that, yes, the turnaround's actually happening.
Yeah, I think the actual business model has got a headwind and has had a headwind for decades, and that's because the actual plane manufacturers want to actually do the training and do the service element because that's their recurring revenue stream.
Yeah.
And so consequently, you've got the likes of Boeing or McDonnell Douglas or any of these guys. When they sell a plane to the military, they basically then put in their own simulator to help train the actual pilots. And so consequently, they're not going to give that unique proprietary, you know, software to a third party to take that high margin service revenue away. So I think that it is they're in a tough ask here because it's like you're not careful, you'll train on Pennant's on simulator, but it'll be something slightly different to the real thing, which comes from anyway, that's all I'd say is that it's a tough one.
It's very, very small revenue, tiny business, really. So you've also got to ask the question, should it really be listed? And I believe the new strategy is to go for sort of SaaS-type revenues, isn't it, rather than large lumpy contracts. And incidentally, the CEO of Interseed, who I know very well and I really highly rate, he's become a non-exec here. So that gives me some confidence. You know, he's a very shrewd, very effective CEO. So I don't suppose he would have got involved at Pennant unless he saw a good potential there. So that's, I think it's an interesting story. We'll keep a close eye on it. But for me, they blotted their copybook, and I'm not going to just jump in and guess that the turnaround will happen. I like to see a catalyst and, you know, something actually happening rather than them hoping it happens, you know.
Yeah, good. Okay, well, I've got to get tip hat to you here, Paul, because 2 or 3 months ago you talked about a company called Gemfields, which owned the Fabergé brand of jewellery. It does basically, I think it's rubies and emerald mining in Africa, Zambia, etc. And they decided to sell it. And you were right, it was worth a shed load. It was sold for 50 million quid. So any quick update on Gemfields? I think you actually did own some shares at one stage, didn't you?
I did. I fluffed my trade on it. I bought them at 6p and sold them at 4p. So I know it's $50 million, actually, they've sold Fabergé for. Now, obviously, in the right hands, that brand, you know, you could be talking long terms worth billions, you know, it's such an iconic brand. So in a way, I thought $50 million was a little bit disappointing, but it hasn't really moved the dial in terms of the shares. I think the problem is it now focuses investors on the remaining business, which is hugely capital intensive. They're spending a fortune on building all this mining equipment in jurisdictions in Africa, as you say. To dig out all these gems, and then they auction them periodically. Yeah. And I mean, they're not susceptible to the issues that diamonds are. Lab-grown diamonds are killing off that sector. So, but I just don't know how to value it now. So it was nice that my idea about Fabergé being hidden value in there did come to fruition. But as you can see from the chart, it's done sod all for investors.
Yeah. That's an interesting comment you make, because I actually did a ChatGPT search on lab-grown jewellery. And obviously everybody knows about diamonds, which is which annihilated De Beers.
Yeah.
But actually ChatGPT came up and said, yeah, absolutely. You can do really good rubies and emeralds in the lab, really? Like you can in diamonds. So they are absolutely, to me, from what ChatGPT said to me, anybody on the board here, if you can know whether they can do lab-grown rubies and emeralds, then please let me know, because...
Everybody's furiously typing into AI now, aren't they?
But
there's a lot of volatility in the price of these auctions as well. I've sort of slunk away with my tail between my legs on Gemfields, and I was right about Fabergé having value, but it didn't play out as a trade as I hoped it would. So never mind, live and learn. So this is exactly why I should keep away from the resources sector.
Okay, good. We got Paul the Parrot. He's asking about Shoe Zone, which came out with a shocker of a profit warning yesterday, and they were talking about surprise, surprise, lower footfall as a shoe retailer into their retail outlets. What was your take on it? Is it a turnaround, value trap, or is it a value play?
I don't know. I'm not going to get involved. I mean, it is cheap now. The market cap's really low. The balance sheet's fine. And as some of the bulls on my chat room were talking about, they were saying, you know, the net cash pile could be a substantial portion of the market cap soon. But, you know, the trouble is, the way I look at it is, they were complaining about all these macro factors in the profit warning. But companies like Next sail straight through and keep putting out ahead of expectations updates. And I know shoes are not a huge part of Next's offering, but I've resolutely believe these guys are having maybe only a small percentage of their revenues being chipped away by the Chinese direct to consumer. Because if you look at Shein and Temu's websites, there's a hell of a lot of shoes on there, you know?
Yeah.
And they're buying them in the same factories that Shoe Zone buy them from, offering them cheap, similar sort of prices, I think. But, you know, they don't come in a box. They just come flat packed, squashed up in one of those air freighted bags. So, and it does, you know, okay, people might want to go into Shoe Zone and try things on, blah, 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 blah. But my point is, if Shein and Temu even take, say, 5% of their revenues, that's their profits gone.
Yeah.
Because of the operational gearing. So for me, I just think it's a bit of an also-ran. Still just about profitable. They halved the profit expectations. I think it's for September 25 from 5 million PBT to 2.5 million PBT, which cash flow would be pretty good because of the depreciation charges. They are doing these new format stores, which seem to work better. Their own online offering is quite good with very low returns rate. So, you know, you can argue either way. I personally just don't see what the catalyst would be for revenues and margins to suddenly start going up again when the trend is that they're under pressure.
I think the only one is if the government decides to insist that the low value items they're basically, you know, import tariff, the actual low value has to pay import tariffs from China. And if they did that, then it would actually protect them. But I'm with you. A lot of sort of like retail, you know, stores, thin margins, selling commodity-like products. That's a tough ask, that is.
It is. I mean, it is really cheap now. That's the only reason to get involved in Shoe Zone is just purely as a value thing. You think, oh, it can't get any cheaper. And maybe the brothers that own 50% of it, maybe they'll take it private. That's another option. But again, why would they be generous? So not for me, but good luck to bulls. And, you know, people have argued a reasonable bull case. It's just on balance, I don't feel it's something I want to get involved with. But good luck.
Yeah. Okay, we've got Casper Mann. He's asking about, do you get any feedback from the FCA when you ask them about the 4imprint trading update last week? Have you got any response at all from them?
I haven't got around to doing it, I'm afraid. It's one of many things on my on my to-do list. So, yeah, Casper Mann, thank you for the kick up the arse. I'll make a note of that on my pad to do that. So, sorry, everyone. I think actually one or two readers have messaged me and said they've written to the FCA. So, good for you. So sorry I haven't got around to doing it, but I will do.
Okay, good. We've got Philly's asking about XP Factory came out with a trading update. I think it might have been yesterday, They basically own the escape rooms and Boom Battle Bars, experiential leisure. Had a really tough first quarter, a better second quarter. Shares have sort of like ticked down a bit. They held their expectations. What's your take overall on the business and the valuation?
Well, I should say I hold some personally, so I'm underwater on them, but that doesn't matter. I'm not interested in what my running P&L is on anything. It's more looking forwards, where will we be in 2 years is my sort of approach. I like it. I think if you look at what management have achieved with hardly any capital, they've done a rollout of two experiential leisure formats in an incredibly difficult environment over the last 3 or 4 years. They're not profitable, but when you take into account the substantial depreciation charges, it is cash generative before expansion capex. You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's loss making, it's cash burning, blah blah blah. It's not. Expansion capex is a policy decision. You don't have to do it. So if they do get tight cash wise they can just stop opening new sites. I think management have achieved a hell of a lot, and they're not really being given the credit for that. And as these Q1 was particularly tough. I was quite surprised that they've only just told us that. They have recouped a fair bit of it in Q2. And they did, interestingly enough, say that they've driven some cost savings, renegotiated supplier contracts that have mitigated a lot of the lost sales, substantially mitigated or something like that. It wasn't quite a profit warning, in my opinion, but it wasn't really in line. They used very clever, you know, hats off to their PR, who came up with some really creative wording to say something like cautiously optimistic about hitting full year forecasts, which basically means we're behind.
Yeah.
We've got our fingers and toes crossed, doesn't it? But no, I think it's fundamentally a good business. It is cash generative. Looking forward again 2 years when consumer might be a bit more settled, wage rises and things might be at lower levels and so on. Of course, 500 plus pubs are going bust every year. So more business for the survivors. I think it's a fighter and a survivor. And I'm perfectly cool with it trading at break even, given how tough macro is, because you can see this concept works. I like it. I think it's too cheap. It doesn't work if you look at it in the way that you or I might look at, you know, a typical value share, that we look at the dividends and the PE of 9. You can't assess it like that. It's a very small growth company that I think it's got potential. So yeah. I'd be disappointed if I don't get 20 to 30p out of this. So a 2 or 3 bagger over the next couple of years. That's my kind of target for it. And that's why I'm holding it. So probably not your cup of tea, Paul, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I was just saying, you know, the last time you did some mystery shopping in that Boom Battle Bar down in Bournemouth.
Bit of axe throwing, yeah.
Axe throwing. Was it busy? I mean, that's the point. Are these facilities actually being used?
Yeah, I do my evening walk quite often down in Bournemouth. I go past the Boom Battle Bar site and occasionally drop in for a beer. They haven't passed on a lot of their price rises to the customers. They're keeping their price of the drinks quite competitive. Okay. And what I've noticed is, this was one that was a franchise but was bought back by the holding companies. I think the franchisee just lost interest in it. You can see it was really badly run. So it's now company owned. And it seems to me that a lot of groups of sort of 20 and 30 somethings use it as a local pub where they can do stuff. In particular, the augmented reality darts is very popular. That part of the bar is always packed.
What's augmented reality darts? Is that with the glasses you wear them? Sort of like, or are they, no, are they sort of like I don't know, homing devices on the arrows?
No, it's a physical darts board, but then it has a computerized system that sort of detects where the darts. So it does the scoring for you automatically.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And you can select all sorts of different games, you know, and choose different. It's really good. And you put your, so it does all the scoring, takes all the hassle out of it, and people love it. So, but there is more emerging competition in experiential leisure for sure. But you see, XP Factory secured a whole load of really good prime sites on very attractive lease terms during the downturn. So I think they've got a lead on the competition, I think.
Yeah, good. Okay, we've got just to switch out sectors. We've got Emma. She's asking about Altitude Group, which I think is a promotional products business, a bit similar to 4 Imprint, but a lot smaller. It's got a, I think it's got a quite a big sort of presence in the US collegiate area. Does lots of sort of like, you know, things like for Harvard or Stanford or, you know, these Berkeley and people like that. So it's much smaller. It's only about sort of like a $20 million market cap, bit of cash, 12 times P. I don't know whether you've ever had a look at it, but it does promotional products anyway for universities, collegiates and businesses.
Yeah, I followed Altitude for many years. It last reported on the 15th of July. Now, the CEO of 8 years stepped down immediately, which was obviously unexpected. So there's clearly been some sort of boardroom bus stop at Altitude. We're not told why. But it did confirm trading in line with expectations. I personally think this is a waste of time. It was originally about a technology platform that would a sort of marketplace for promotional goods that would revolutionize the industry. It just hasn't worked. So what they've done instead is they branched out into other niches, as you say, like the US universities branded products for them. So it's one of these companies where I think the original business model hasn't worked. So they're pivoting to something similar that might work. So it just doesn't interest me. No.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Brilliant. Let's move sectors. We've got IT, basically .digital, which does. I think it does sort of marketing, sort of software, sort of messaging, etc. for corporates, and it bought a business, I think, with sort of like social, I can't remember what it was called, social snowball, was it, or something like that. It was to do basically with the influencer market. I'm surprised how it's, given it's a software business, SaaS revenues, it trades on less than 2x sales and about 14x PE. I don't know whether you had a look at this. It's definitely cheap.
Yeah, again, this is one we follow closely and have done for years. It always looks reasonably cheap when we look at it, but there's a reason for that. It's because they're not getting any new business in. They're just the churn is and basically all the growth in the last few years has come from additional revenues from existing clients. And basically new client wins just offset customer churn. That is their fundamental problem. But it's got tons of cash. Social snowball, that's right. It's still got 36 million of cash after paying for social snowball. So the question is, can they simulate some growth by buying in things that make it start to look like a growth company again? And then I suppose they'll hope it'll re-rate to a PE of 20 or 30 or something. And there was no clear guidance as well, we thought, with the 28th of July trading update. But, you know, they said it's got a strong pipeline, robust financial position, which is true, growing partner network. So we think it's quite good, but I don't see a catalyst for it re-rating. I think it's cheap for a reason. And it is 94% recurring revenue. And it's basically, it's quite old hat, I think. It's email marketing software. But once customers use it, it's clear that they're very loyal, and so the software is clearly good. But you do think, in this brave new world of AI and all the rest of it, how relevant is email marketing going to be going forwards? I don't know. So I think that's why it's on a modest rating.
Yeah. No, I mean, the amount of email, the success rate of email marketing texting is just. It must have a low hit rate, low conversion, I would have thought, because it just becomes nuisance, doesn't it? It's all that spam stuff.
I guess so, yeah. But apparently this software, I saw a product demo of this software a few years ago, and it does look very good. And the fact that the clients that use it buy more licenses, you know, and agree to price rises and things, tells you it must be good. But what longevity of it, I don't know.
Good. Okay. In that same software space, we've got Clive. He's asking about Truefin, which is basically a group of three companies. Came out with a stonking profit upgrade today. Got three divisions. It's got its. It does basically gaming software, so it makes it builds games, etc. PlayStack, and then it's got some forward funding business, and also some invoice discounting business as well. Stargo and Oxygen, I think they're called. Anyway, what was your take on their trading update? The market's up, as I say, the shares are up 16% today.
Well, this one is my colleague Dave. He's written about this one a number of times this year. So he analysed that in this morning's Substack report, actually. It was a trading update to June 25. As you say, stonking update from them. Very good numbers. They're way well ahead of expectations. Broker forecasts have been raised considerably. The only way to value it really is some of the parts, as you say. I'm not personally keen on these mini conglomerates with three separate businesses, because then you've basically got to value three companies separately and do some of the parts. One of your fund managers likes this, doesn't he? And he updates us on it.
Yeah, Gresham House like it. I think M&G have got in there as well. There's quite a few actually. Yeah.
So we felt we didn't really know how to value it, although obviously we're impressed with what the shares have done and the materially ahead update for the full year. My colleague Dave pointed out that the growth is coming from this video games subsidiary.
Yes.
I think, is it PlayStack?
Yeah, it's PlayStack.
Jumping
yeah.
out to me. Yeah. So as Dave points out, the problem with these video games companies is you can't rely on, they've had a couple of bumper product releases, but they're shooting stars. You know, they make all the big money comes in one fell swoop when the products launch. It's difficult to value them on a PE basis, gaming companies, unless they've got, what do they call it? A franchise, you know, where they can release, like the Football Manager games, where you just do a release after release after release every year. And they sell regular clockwork. So, but we certainly think it looks interesting, and it's done really, really well. Truefin has. So, we're neutral on it. But you know, it was a lovely update. So well done to holders. Yeah.
Yeah. Now they do seem to be pretty good at finding new games, because it was the first one. I think it was Mortal Shell, and then they had Balatro, and then the one today has also done very well. So they are sort of like creating this back catalogue, which is why I think investors are now starting to sort of think about recurring revenue streams rather than one-off hits. So
It could be good then. Yeah, definitely. No, I mean, don't get me wrong. We like it. We just we're not really in the business of predicting the future. We just look at the numbers as of now, you know. And I mean, are they still looking to sell Oxygen? This is the early payment business.
That's a very good question.
Or I mean, they've got an offer. Yeah, they turned down an offer, didn't they? Yeah,
they did. Yeah. I don't know, but I think if they got an acceptable price, they would do. No doubt about it.
Yeah, okay. PlayStack looks to be the jewel in the crown, doesn't it?
Yeah, about 5 years ago, it was always Satago, because they had that inked that deal with Lloyd's, and now it's moved to the PlayStack. But it's amazing how perceptions of and what happens with business models. You've got to be flexible and move with the times.
I've just realised I can look at the questions from the readers. I've never realised that before.
I
can just see them there.
No, I know. Yeah, right. We got a question on Calnex. They came out with a trading update today. They basically do telco testing equipment, etc. Big equipment for data centres and the telco sector. I don't know whether you had a look at this. Still seems to be sort of like work in progress.
Yeah, I mean, we look at practically everything these days. So, we looked at this one, CLX, today. Rose 2%, 49p. That was about 11 o'clock this morning. AGM statement. I think it was in line. Yeah, here we are. They said confident that March 26 year-end will be in line with expectations. No change to the broker forecast. The only problem with this one, I didn't look at this myself. Dave wrote these notes. I have a feeling it's operating around break-even now, isn't it? Calnex has been highly profitable in the past. Then an industry downturn knocked it right back again. So I think it's straightforward. Well, not straightforward, but I think it's a simple investing thesis. If you think it can get back to previous levels of profitability, then you're probably doubling or tripling your money. It said that its markets were stabilizing, so that doesn't sound particularly bullish. Got a nice balance sheet, about a quarter of the market cap in net cash. So that gives you a very nice copper bottom sort of floor to your risk reward. And it said telecoms markets remain stable, growing traction in cloud and defense, and an expanding partner network. So it doesn't look like there's any immediate catalyst there. Does there? This is more your type of thing, Paul. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's good technology. I mean, I've actually spoken to the management team, both hardware and software side. The key is getting the distribution, and that's what they need to do. And they obviously lost that important partner, the Aspirant, which has been bought out. And so they've been sort of like trying to recover that volume. But if they can actually get a bigger shop window for their leading technology and commercialize it over a larger, you know, footprint, then it will do very well. I think it probably needs to be part of a bigger group, you know.
Yeah.
But hey, that would be just my. It needs to be, because the problem is the telco industry is full of absolute giants, and therefore need a bit of some negotiating power and a number of different products to be able to offset those ones which are going through tougher times. But fundamentally, it should do well out of AI and data center builds.
Yeah, sounds quite interesting. And as I say, given that you've got that balance, if I'm going to have to sort of guess how a company is going to perform, I want it to have a bulletproof balance sheet, because then I don't have to worry, oh, emergency placing, massive dilution if something goes wrong. So yeah. I do think it's important to have that balance sheet backing, which you've got very strongly with Calnex. So, yeah, if somebody said, somebody had to, if people have got some industry knowledge and they can say, ah, because of this, this, and this, I suspect it'll do well, that's the type of thing to go for. I don't think, for those of us who don't really know anything about that sector, I try not to avoid just total pumps, really. Yeah. I'd like to see some evidence that something's, maybe some substantial director buys. If you've got some directors loading up with 50, 100 grand of the stock, that might be the type of catalyst to tip me over into having a little dabble in it, maybe.
I think you'll wake up one morning and it'll have had 100% premium on some, a trade buy will pick it up myself. But wouldn't surprise me at some point.
Do we know what the shareholding structure is? Do management own a lot?
I think the founder CEO has got a big chunk still. So
yeah, that rings a bell. I think you might be right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we got AA31 and Grant both asking quick update on Beeks Financial, which obviously does that ultra secure sort of high frequency trading equipment and software that goes into stock exchanges around the world, and has got a big contract with is it Mexico, NASDAQ, and
And Canada, Australia. And yeah, Canada, that's right. Yeah. I love it. I mean, I am sort of, I suppose, emotionally attached to this, really. I think it's such a one of the UK's best compound growth companies, small caps. You know, it's doing 25% per annum compound top line growth. It's moved into profit now, probably won't need any more fundraisers, but the market just lost interest in it. And as you can see from that chart, it's slowly finding its feet again. But the update this week I thought was good. It was something about launching a new AI-fueled trading analysis type service embedded in this, or right next to the servers. That was it, 13th of August. Was that? Yeah, that was this. Yeah, yesterday. And it sounded very good. I mean, no change to the forecast. So you could argue this probably shouldn't change the share price. But they did say, I mean, the update sounded very upbeat. They said they've got really positive customer feedback for this new product, AI market analysis tool. That was it. And it expands the total addressable market. There's upselling and increased recurring revenues they think they'll get from this. So I think it's a nice kind of reassuring that they're innovating and launching new products. 149 million market cap, I think, is cheap. For the moment, but the market just wants to take a breather on it. That's just the way it goes sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I
don't think you've ever really felt any strong views on.
No, I mean, I think it's in a good place, and just makes total sense putting that type of AI software project service on top of their existing platform, because it's going to be pure profit that you can add on and upsell into clients. So yeah, I think it makes that's a great idea in my view.
It does seem to, doesn't it? And the thing I particularly like about Beeks, it seems to be the de facto standard now for niche cloud services, specifically designed for stock markets, but also, you know, commodities exchanges, any type of financial exchange. They've even done some crypto type stuff. It seems to be the niche provider for that sector, which should mean that each reference site, I mean, the NASDAQ, bloody hell, you can't get a better reference site than that. But they're actually more excited about the secondary and tertiary type stock markets, where, you know, say a UK-based hedge fund might want access, but to build their own, servers and all that sort of thing would be beyond their reach. So something like Beeks, where you can literally just activate it by, you know, just logging in and creating an account, you've then got pretty much direct access to that market. That's a pretty compelling offering, I think. So I've got high hopes for Beaks, but yes, I'm having to be patient at the moment.
No, I would agree. Okay, right. We've got Steve Lewis. He's asking about accountant MHA that basically listed, I think, earlier this year at £1. The shares have done really well. Reported today, they're £1.40. They're sort of like, I think it's a second tier sort of accountant, does all financial services. But
yeah,
I've put a foot wrong in terms of their performance so far since listing.
Yeah, isn't it nice to see a successful listing at long last, you know, that wasn't overpriced and that has performed well. So well done to the brokers. I think it was Cavendish who floated this. They've had a few duffers over the last few years, but also some successes like this that should be highlighted. I think it's Baker Tilly, isn't it, the brand that they're we don't have a strong view on these things. I'm not personally a fan of this hybrid model of partners taking a big profit share and then the listed company owners getting a chunk of it because some of the partners essentially wanted to cash their chips in for their equity early. So I don't personally tend to buy into these things, but I do think the insolvency guys, Begbies Traynor and FRP, are very attractively priced. Similar sort of businesses, but I don't think MHA has a focus particularly on the insolvency side. I think it's more on the audit and advisory, isn't it? But so far so good on this one. My colleague Dave had a brief look at it this morning. What is it today? 14th. Yeah, that was it. It was on track to meet market expectations, it says. Demand continues to rise. There is a shortage of auditors as well because nobody was trained throughout the pandemic. So it's a license to print money now for these guys. So I think it could be interesting. Yeah. And we got a forecast of just over 10p. So what are the shares now? About £1.40.
£1.40,
14 times PE. Probably priced about right, maybe.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Albeit there is a lot of private equity money rolling up accountants at the moment.
So it would not
surprise me if, having just listed the business, it actually then gets taken out by a lot of these bigger.
Because they bought. Possible.
There's one of them who bought Cooper Parry about 2 years ago, who then are rolling up certain ones. So there's plenty of it in terms, because it's classed as regulated industry that has recurring revenue streams and people quite like then loading it up with debt.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good point. And also you've got just increasing accounting regulations and complexity that means these guys, and as I say, a shortage of auditors. So these guys are doing really well. You know, they're in a lucrative sweet spot, I think. So it could be quite interesting.
Yeah. Good. Okay. What about the recruiter Page Group that came out with results, I think, today? These shares have, over the last 5 years, have really been clobbered, unfortunately. In fact, all of the recruiters are. What was your take on theirs? I think their NFI was down, which is their effectively de facto revenues were down mid-single digits again. And it's just, go on.
This sector is really sick, I think. I mean, this was 2 days ago, and not as in a young person using the word sick. Sick as in you or you or I would say. It's in trouble, I think. And one of my readers, Heather, she actually said, because I've been asking the question, I don't know the answer, but is something going structurally wrong with this sector, the staffing companies? Because this downturn has just gone on and on and on. It's getting worse internationally. Yeah. Remember, these are international groups. Page Group is now basically only trading at break even, but it's still valued at 800 odd million. So to me, I mean, the market is betting on a big cyclical recovery here. But Heather pointed out, she said at the company she or her friend works for, she said they're doing all their recruiting through LinkedIn.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? Now, that may not be typical, but if you lose 5 or 10% of your business permanently to LinkedIn, you've got big problems. So I'm very tempted to pick up some Robert Walters or some S3. I think those are my sector picks. And funnily enough, Gattaca's doing quite well. Despite people telling us it was the dog of the sector, they're actually doing all right. So it is tempting to bottom fish in this sector, but things just seem to be going from bad to worse, don't they?
Any views, Paul? I think the whole sector's a value trap myself. I wouldn't be running into it. I just think it's permanently damaged by new technology and LinkedIn and AI and this sort of stuff. And until you find, I mean, the lower level, middle level of management, is there really a USP in finding those people? There is top level headhunting. I totally get it. In fact, that is, you know, that will stay. But that's a very small niche part of the business. It's volume, basically, that people like Paige look after, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I looked also at Paige's, I didn't write up a full section, but I did look through the accounts, and the net cash was down 81% to only 11 million. Yeah. And I looked at the cash flow statement, and the problem is the divvies. They're not a generous dividend payer, but they're uncovered divvies. And what you've got to bear in mind, I think we saw a similar thing actually with Robert Walters, did have a bulletproof balance sheet, but because they've carried on paying the generous divvies, if it's not covered by earnings, that rapidly hollows out your balance sheet. So I wouldn't rely on any of the dividends from this sector. I think they could all pull those dividends to protect their balance sheets. So I just think the page, I think the market cap's way too high based on current performance. So good luck to people who are hoping for that turnaround, but there's absolutely no sign of it.
Yeah, as I say, I've, you know, to me, the whole sector's a value trap, and it isn't something I would want to bottom fish until hit the bottom.
It's looking that way to me as well, I have to say.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've got Questor Aware. He's basically asking about B&M. Their shares, again, ski slope job, just keep getting down and down. They, you know, basically the out-of-town retailer of all things, sort of like non-grocery, but you can get Tupperware and you can get everything in these stores. Anyway, what's your treasure hunt type of shop? What's your take on it?
I know it's underperformed with a number of profit warnings, but I just can't get my head around why the shares have fallen this much. I mean, the latest share scope data is showing forecast PE of 7x.
Yes.
Dividend yield of 6.8%. So you've got basically PE and divvy yield forecast the same, which, I think the red arrows might be going over. Can you hear that? No, they do. They go directly over my penthouse. It's so exciting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, concentrate, Paul. So the only downside with B&M, I think, well, like you say, they keep putting out mild profit warnings, but they're not—they're not serious profit warnings. And the balance sheet's not the best. It's hollowed out the balance sheet a bit with a bit too much debt, but not dangerous. So I've got to say, I think it looks really attractive. I don't think it's a value trap. It's a very commercial, adaptive sort of business. You know, they don't just stock all the same products. They buy what they can find cheap, and it's almost like a gigantic covered market stall. I think it looks very attractive valuation at the moment, but there again, I've been saying that all the way down.
When you look at prices, do they beat online the Timus and the Sheens? And if you do get a change in that tariff legislation, that will be a turning point for the business.
Yes.
But at the moment, I think it isn't just the cost of getting stuff online, which is so difficult to beat. It's actually the convenience. I mean, you know, I always go online because even if it's a bit more expensive, it just comes to my door. I haven't got to go out the house, and I can just enjoy my life and not have to waste. I don't like retail therapy, basically. So,
you know. True, but I mean, I know what you mean, but we've got to think in terms of the broader population and what they do. And I mean, if you look at the long, all I would say to people on B&M is, if you look at the long term track record of it, you know, over say 10 years, it's been a phenomenally successful business. It really has. And it did exceptionally well throughout the pandemic, and it's held on to most of those profits. So I think at some point sentiment on the share could well turn. So I have to say, I do like it, but I've no idea when it's going to stop falling. That's the trouble, isn't it? So I think it's the sort of, if I had some spare cash, this would be near the top of my list, I think, to initiate a new position.
Yeah, good. Okay, we've just got one final question. We've got Magnets 1000. He's asking about Softcat, which I think is an IT value-added reseller. So it takes software and implements it in the UK, whether it's digitalization for the public and private sector, and also probably does a bit of hardware in there as well to help the sort of software sales. Was a bit of a darling. Shares have fallen quite a lot. I don't know if you've had a look at this one. It's quite a big company, I think.
Yeah, it's very big. 3.1 yeah. billion market cap. The only thing I would say is, looking at the basic numbers here, you get a 3% yield, but it's on a forward PE of 23 times. Yeah. What is it? SFT, the ticker, isn't it? Is that right, Paul?
SCT.
SCT.
Yes, yeah, too, yeah.
I'll just call it out. I'm sure I've written about this. Yeah, I've covered this twice this year, in March and in May. Just neutral on it. We think the revenue growth, the EPS growth, is a bit lackluster, but it was on a PE of 23. I think we'd want more rapid growth to want to get involved. Its balance sheet's good. For the size of company, most 3 billion plus companies got horrible geared balance sheets. This hasn't. This has got a bit of net cash. So we like that. It seems to be performing well this year. It's slightly ahead in March. Strong double-digit year-on-year growth and operating profit in May. Well, maybe it is growing better. So, it looks okay. It doesn't particularly appeal to me. I'm just neutral on this one. I wouldn't say anything bad about it. Valuation-wise, though, I'm just neutral. Do you look at this one, Paul?
Yeah, I would say... with that valuation, I definitely wouldn't be moving in at this level, simply because the direction of travel for software is into the cloud, and we've seen that. And that means this is less implementation at the value-added reseller side to customize it, because it has to be an all-in-one type bit of software. Yes, you do get a bit of customization, but not as much. It's decreasing. The investment thesis here is, as AI is implemented in the public sector and the private sector, then these guys like Accenture are really going to benefit, because they're going to have shed loads of, you know, sort of like business to help companies get the best out of generative AI. But I think that will be actually quite a crowded market. So I think you're paying a lot for that growth, given the headwinds of where the software is going to. And some reselling hardware is low margin anyway. But they've done a great job. They must have some good management team to justify a PE of over 20.
There's obviously something good there, isn't there? Yeah. Yes,
there is. Yeah, but it wouldn't be something I'd be chasing, because your quality of your people is really what will distinguish you, and how you can, you know, basically develop and win market share from other people. But it's becoming more crowded, particularly as governments and corporates don't implement or delay their big chain digitization projects, you know, because then we've seen that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I bow to your expertise in this, Paul. It's not really a sector I know. And, you know, if it was on a PE of 9 or something and giving a 6% dividend yield, I'd take a look. When things are, you know, on punchy ratings, I tend to just swiftly move on, really, and look elsewhere. Yeah.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks everyone for your questions. Probably haven't been able to get through all of them. Hold them, and then we'll talk through with Paul next week. Just for everybody's day to the diary, we're going to do it at 2 o'clock next Wednesday, not next Thursday, and we'll be good to go. So, thanks again, Paul. Terrific comments.
Great pleasure. I love doing these, Paul. Good fun. Thanks to all the audience participation as well.
Yeah, and the question was at the end of the question is was it the red arrows which flew over? Was it?
I don't know. I have to do some googling, but they do their normal route. They just come right over my flat. It's brilliant.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot. We'll see you next 2 o'clock, same channel, next Wednesday. Thanks,
guys.
Next
Wednesday. Brilliant. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.